Well, as I've just suggested, Palm Sunday is the day when the church remembers how Jesus entered Jerusalem. He was greeted by those pilgrims. It was less than a week before he died. We're going to move forward a few days to the events that were recounted in our reading. We've heard about the first of two meals that we read about in Mark chapter 14. We're going to be thinking about these two occasions, and then we're going to look at some images which will lead us to some final thoughts about this last week in the life of Jesus. And also, we're going to be thinking about our own lives as we try to follow him. The first meal happened in the village of Bethany. It was a place where Jesus had friends, and it was where he stayed while visiting Jerusalem for the Passover festival. We might compare it to somebody visiting St. Albans and staying with friends in Park Street, say, or if they were particularly posh, Harpenden. There are a number of stories in the Gospels which have some details that we find also in this story. The common facts are that a woman anoints Jesus with a precious oil, which offends certain other people who witness what happens. It's not easy to tell whether these stories are different witnesses, versions of one event, or that they're similar but separate incidents that happened at different times and in different places. In this particular story, the meal took place in the house of someone called Simon the leper. Now, this is not a great name to have been given if we assume that Simon didn't actually choose it for himself. We might consider it rather insensitive to draw attention to a person's disease in this way. However, what's even more odd is that this meal took place in the house of someone with that name. It was quite out of the question that people who were free of leprosy would eat with lepers, or that a leper would have his own house in a village alongside other people. So it's almost certain that Simon was not a leper when the meal took place. Was Simon one of those whom Jesus healed, perhaps? In which case his name would allude to his former life in much the way that Zacchaeus might have been called Zacchaeus the crook. A more sobering thought is that Simon contracted leprosy at a later date. And only then, perhaps years after the happier times in which this meal took place, was he given this rather chilling name, the leper. Well, that's to some extent irrelevant in that Simon has no part in the story, except to locate the scene, to tell us where this event happened. Alongside Jesus, the other important character in the story is the woman. She is not named here, but in other places she has been identified as someone called Mary. You might be surprised that it wasn't Mary Magdalene with whom she was identified. This association came much later, long after the Bible had been written. Now, the Mary in question was the sister of Martha and Lazarus. The woman who was commended by Jesus for sitting and listening rather than hustling and bustling to prepare a meal. But here, the woman's unnamed, although we will see that there are some links with the story of Mary and Martha. Another point where these various stories diverge is that here it's Jesus' head that the woman anoints with perfumed oil. Elsewhere, it's Jesus' feet that are anointed or washed with oil, or indeed with the woman's tears and then dried with her hair. This difference, while perhaps subtle to our minds, affects the nature of the objections of those who witnessed what went on. You see, it was quite usual to anoint the head of a dinner guest with perfumed oil. It was intended to refresh after a journey. We might compare this to being offered a roll of hot flannel in a Chinese restaurant, perhaps. But what was unusual here was firstly that a woman had entered a room where men were dining, but more significant, as we see from the specific nature of the objections, was the way in which she anointed Jesus. I said that it's quite common to sprinkle scented oil on the head of a dinner guest, but it's quite unusual, if not perhaps unique, to pour out the whole contents of a jar of perfume as expensive as nard. This was only obtained from a plant that was grown only in India. We're told in the story that the whole jar would have cost more than 300 denarii, roughly equating to a year's wages for a working man. Perhaps the only occasion when people would have such an anointing would be the one time when they would least appreciate it, after they died. And then the broken shards of the jar would be left alongside the anointed body. In other versions of the story, the woman is criticised as being immoral. But here it's the profligacy of what she's done that arouses the righteous indignation of these unnamed guests, some of whom we would guess were Jesus' closest companions. But Jesus, he's siding with the woman. Now, this wasn't the first time that Jesus sided unexpectedly against the majority view in defence of another. Once, when his disciples were said not to have been fasting at the appropriate time, Jesus made reference to the more important need to feast while the bridegroom is present. Here he makes a similar defence of this woman. Those present raised the predictable but not unreasonable argument that occurs whenever Christians debate about how money should be spent. Should it be used to alleviate poverty or in an act of extravagant worship? Jesus told the woman's accusers, much like he told Martha, that she'd chosen well. In this instance, Jesus, who frequently demonstrated God's alleged bias towards the poor, said that it was timing that was important here. This was what he said to those who accused the disciples of feasting instead of fasting. But here there's a different emphasis. It was that time was running out for her to be able to do this particular thing for him. An anointing such as this would usually happen in the hours after death. But bearing in mind that the Sabbath prevented anything happening for 24 hours after he died, Jesus would be raised, gone from the tomb by the time the woman would have her chance again. That was the first meal. The second meal took place on the night before Jesus died. Now, the beginning of this chapter has caused some problems for those who like their I's dotted and their T's crossed. The problems arise over when this meal took place, which in turn affects what sort of meal it was and on what day Jesus died. But we're not going to worry about these matters, which are problems really for lesser mortals than us. And we'll assume that the meal took place on a Thursday evening, on the night before Jesus died. We'll assume that it was also a Passover meal, because that's what Mark tells us in his story. But these questions relating to timing to the Passover are almost incidental in relation to another query which verses 1 and 2 of chapter 14 throw up. Jesus, you see, had already caused a commotion in the temple when he upset the tables of the money changers and he set those sacrificial pigeon sellers' birds in all sorts of directions. It was after that incident that, in their desire to maintain their positions and to avoid a heavy-handed Roman reaction to a breach of the peace, some of the Jewish leaders became more convinced than ever that Jesus was going to have to go. And so they plotted against him. They were clearly concerned that if Jesus provoked the people to rise up, before long things were going to get completely out of hand. By the time we arrive at Bethany for this first meal of Holy Week, the need to be rid of Jesus will seem to be more acute than ever. But the Jewish leaders have decided that the timing of the Passover festival wasn't going to be opportune for such an action. Not during the festival, was what they said. But then they went and did it anyway. Why is there this apparent discrepancy between what seems to have been their intention and what those frightened leaders finally did just 2 days later? Well, here are three possible answers. One is that there wasn't a discrepancy at all. When they said not during the festival, they meant not in public among the crowds, which is why they took Jesus by night and away from the busiest parts of Jerusalem. A second possibility is that in Judas Iscariot, they were presented with an opportunity that they hadn't planned. Judas was the source of new intelligence which prompted the coalition of chief priests and scribes to carry out a sort of surgical strike in the Garden of Gethsemane and so decapitate the Jesus regime. That possibility is related to a third reason, which is that the whole course of events was shown by Mark not to be the result of the actions of self-seeking rulers, but that it happened because of the irresistible will of God. Now, my inclination is that all three reasons have truth within them, but that the last reason, that this was the result of the irresistible will of God, would be Mark's preferred option. My reason for suggesting that Mark wants his readers to see the events of Holy Week as God's plan is that he shows little interest at why Jesus did what he did. When Matthew and John tell this story, they waste no time in portraying Judas's motives as anything other than financial. While Mark tells us that the leaders offered Judas money, he'd already gone to them to betray Jesus, and Mark makes no comment with regard to Judas having asked for money, or, as does John, suggests that he was already guilty of having his fingers in the till. So if Mark's motives are not revealed, we're left to wonder, was he perhaps one of those who'd become disillusioned with Jesus? Was Judas disillusioned with Jesus because he wasn't the revolutionary leader that Judas had hoped for? He was disappointed in Jesus. But we're left with this strong impression that the betrayal of Jesus was part of God's plan. And it's always very difficult for us to understand this, isn't it? Because Jesus said it would be better for you, or better for the one that betrayed me, that he hadn't been born. And yet Judas was part of God's plan too. This is one of the mysteries of the gospel story. To be part of God's plan in this way could suggest that, rather like Martin Luther, these religious leaders could do no other. But God's kingdom doesn't really work like that. He calls women and men to follow him, as Judas was called by Jesus to be one of the 12. A point that Mark emphasises. But this doesn't mean to say that we have a chip implanted in our brains which prevents disobedience. We can easily go against God's will. Not a great surprise me telling you that, is it? You know that. I know that. And Judas rejected God's call in a major way. That's no different, though, from the way that all Christian people have a tendency to resist what they know to be God's will. God calls us to be part of his plan, but he also gives us freedom to disobey him. But our disobedience doesn't mean that God's plan is thwarted any more than Judas thwarted the work of God's kingdom. So the preparations for the meal began with Jesus giving a similar series of instructions to those he gave regarding the animal he used when he rode into Jerusalem. And once again, the sense of these events having been planned ahead is apparent. Then at a time of closest fellowship, Jesus drops his bombshell. One of the 12 will betray him. The response of the disciples wasn't to ask who it would be, which we might have expected, but rather they simply wanted confirmation that it wasn't them. Perhaps they thought somewhere inside each of them, maybe it will be me. And while Judas was the one who betrayed Jesus, none of the others was rock solid, as Peter would soon prove. And Jesus just ignored their questions and said simply that it was one of the 12. And he then said that it was the one who was dipping bread into the dish with him. This was not intended to give a clue as to who it was, as part of the Passover tradition was that everyone there would dip their bread into a common dish. It was to emphasize instead the depth of this betrayal. It was someone who had shared this most intimate of moments, a fellowship meal. Someone who shared a fellowship meal with Jesus would be one who would betray him. Well, just to pause for a moment, and I'm going to come back to a conclusion, but I want to think about a I'll show you two pictures that you may think initially are unrelated, but stay with me. Let me switch over. It's a very famous picture taken in Times Square, New York City, on VJ Day in August 1945. It shows a sailor kissing a nurse. Apparently they didn't know each other. He just sort of, you know, went for it, saw his opportunity. When US soldiers entered Baghdad in 2003, at the end of the Second Gulf War, they were met by smiling faces. This is about liberation. There were women waving. There were lads wanting to play football, clearly not realising that Americans think you play football with a different shaped ball from a round one. Same thing happened in Paris in 1944. People waved at the incoming soldiers. This picture taken for a fashion magazine juxtaposes an elegant Parisian woman posing next to a German tank. You might have noticed tanks featured quite heavily in those photographs. Freedoms tend to be bought at a price, the loss of many lives and countless more damaged bodies and minds, and maybe the symbol of the force that's used is the tank. Here's a picture of another occasion when tanks rolled into a city. It's early June 1989, Tiananmen Square in Beijing. Throughout the spring of that year, the square in the centre of the capital, one of the world's most authoritarian regimes, had been filled with students, office workers. They were coming together to call for greater democracy in China, but then after 7 weeks, the authorities said, "We can't put up with this anymore," and they sent the tanks in. And the world was watching as one man stood in front of a column of 17 tanks and didn't move. What was going to happen? Standing in an ordinary white shirt, dark trousers, seemed to be holding his shopping bag. His tank swerved one way and then another. He moved each time, cutting off the path. And then he climbed aboard and spoke to the tank commander and said, "Why are you here? My city is in chaos because of you." He then climbed down and was whisked back into the crowd. He became known as, or was named as, Wang Weilin. Although no one knows for sure if that's correct. No one knows why he did it. In fact, nobody knows what became of him. But it's said that in those few moments he became a symbol of revolution and was seen by more people than ever laid eyes on Winston Churchill in the flesh. What happened next is open to some debate, but there were certainly many people killed, whether publicly or in prisons. No one knows for sure what happened to Wang Weilin, if that was indeed his name. But what he did was a gesture of self-offering. We've heard of another act of self-offering this week, haven't we? This gendarme, quite a senior officer in France, who exchanged his life for a hostage outside Carcassonne. I don't know if you've ever wondered, I'm guessing possibly you may not have done, how foundations are built on soft or marshy land. Huge cranes are used to hammer long lengths of piling into the soft ground until they find, in the words of one old construction worker, refusal. The piles refuse to go even one more inch as they hit the bedrock that brings them to a standstill. And refusal can also be the way in which people, many of whom are Christian, resist the seemingly overwhelming powers that are lined up against them. What Wang Weilin did has been done by many Christians, from Martin Luther through Dietrich Bonhoeffer to Martin Luther King to Archbishop Romero in El Salvador. They have been prepared to resist evil and to offer all for the sake of God's kingdom. It's what the woman did at the meal in Bethany. When Andrew Motion was poet laureate, he wrote a poem that he titled Regime Change. These are some lines from it. Advancing down the road from Nineveh, Death paused a while and said, "Now listen here. You see the names of places round about? They're mine now, and I've turned them inside out. Take Babylon, the palace sprouting flowers which sweetened empires in their peaceful hours. I found a different way to scent the air. Already it's a byword for despair. Which leaves Baghdad, the star-tipped minarets, the marble courts and halls, the mirage heat. These places and the ancient things you know, you won't know soon. I'm working on it. Struck me that there were a couple of links to our thoughts this evening. There is the idea of a scent in the air. Not sure whether you can detect a scent in the air. You may be able to. You've put some candles around the place which may be able to scent the air in our room here tonight. And that poem mentions a scent in the air, and clearly there was a scent in the air when the woman broke that jar of ointment. But it also seems to me that the events of Holy Week are about regime change. They're about the change from the regime of this world, in which might is right, and self-interest is the motive that governs all that realm's dealings. Jesus stood in front of the tanks of the Roman Empire. He allowed himself to be crushed. And he did this to demonstrate how life should be lived. And he did it to bring about regime change. From now on, God's kingdom will be at large in our world. But, and again, borrowing from the news that we see time after time, even though the battle is won, it's not yet over. And while we struggle to follow Jesus in a world in which, for many, he is as unknown as man, the tank man, we continue to look for signs of God's kingdom. Signs of light in dark places. Green shoots where once there was only barren earth. And we must look too for the regime change in our own hearts. We must seek strength to be those people who refuse. People who refuse. People who refuse to accept that darkness has defeated light. People who proclaim that the world doesn't have to be like this. People who refuse to let their fears and their doubts govern how they live their lives. And like the woman at that meal, we must be people who seize the moment. Who seize the moment when the opportunity is presented to us and give all the love of Jesus.